Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is coming to you straight from Birdsville and Verona, Italy. No, not really. Well, kind of. We're in Sydney, Australia as we record this. However, when you listen to this, Doc will be in sunny, hopefully, Verona in Italy, and I will be up in the Channel Country, up in Birdsville in Queensland. We'll talk a little bit of that later, but firstly, g'day Doc, how are you, mate?
I'm good, man, how are you?
I'm exceptionally well. I'm much better than usual because I'm not here, and neither are you.
Well, I hope I'm good.
Mate, Verona in Italy, well, you can't not be, come on. Who has a terrible time in Verona?
Well, you know, my wife's going to conference, right? And I'm going to basically spend time with my daughter there. So
fantastic.
That you know, in some form, sounds like, you know, I'm babysitting. So hopefully the coffee there is good.
That sounds pretty good.
Coffee and pizza. And
I'd ask you to bring some back for me, but it's probably not going to be great by the time you're back, is it?
That's probably true. And plus, you know, our biosecurity laws.
You couldn't read.
I don't want to be in the long queue waiting for, you know, somebody to approve my products.
If we're not back next week, that's because Doc is stuck at customs at Sydney Airport.
Yeah.
So you're going to be in Verona, which is pretty bloody exciting. I am heading up to the Birdsville Big Red Bash, which is happening next week in the time that our listeners listen to this, in a couple of weeks' time as we're recording it. It's going to be pretty cool. In fact, as we speak right now, I'm actually, in theory, somewhere around the Innamica Hotel or the Birkin Wills Dig Tree on my way to Birdsville. If, good Lord's willing, the creeks don't rise, I could be somewhere else entirely if the car breaks down or if other untoward, unexpected circumstances happen. For those who are interested, by the way, I intend to cover a little bit of my trip on Twitter and maybe Instagram. So TMF Scott P. I will hijack my own Twitter feed, my own Instagram feed, throw a couple of photos up there and maybe a couple of funny stories if there are any. So if you are so inclined, feel free to follow along. That's just if you want to. Frankly, by the way, if you don't want to follow along, just mute me for a couple of weeks because I will be back on about the 22nd or so of July. So feel free to unmute me then and don't miss any of the good investing stuff. But if you want to miss the holiday stuff, it's probably a good couple of weeks to take off.
Captain, I'm expecting you to catch some pictures of, you know, big snakes and big animals.
Cool. Yeah.
You know, so like, you know, find me like a python or something.
Mate, if I'm close enough to photograph it, just quietly, I'll be running the other way.
Well, just you know, use your zoom. I hope your Pixel phone has got a zoom. But
it has.
Know.
I've got a Canon little digital camera that will take. So
find me a python. Or something. So find me something exotic.
My young lady will be very, very excited. Mate, let's stop talking about us because it's not about, well, of course it's about us. I mean, this is, you know, narcissism central, as our listeners well know.
It's all about you.
It's all about us. Come on.
It's all about you.
Come on. We're both narcissistic and have fragile ego. So it's not just about our travels, though. Hopefully, if you're listening to this and you find yourself at Birdsville, come and say good day. I'll be the one in the hat at the Big Red Bash, and there's only about 9,000 of us, so I shouldn't be too hard to find.
Yeah.
Just follow the Twitter feed. All right, mate. So we've got a bit of a different podcast this week. Because we're recording this one in advance, we thought rather than try and reflect on the news of the day, which would be very, very hard because neither you nor I have a working crystal ball. Otherwise, we'd be much richer and we wouldn't be doing stock picking for a living. We'd be in Bahamas somewhere. We're going to talk about a couple of investing kind of themes, some ideas, some concepts, some stuff that we hope our listeners will enjoy getting some interesting insights in from you and occasionally from me, some of the bigger topics that are going around the investing world right now, the business world, just kind of digging into some stuff we don't normally make time for. So I'm kind of looking forward to this. Hopefully you are too, and hopefully our listeners will enjoy it. Let's get into it.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I'm going to start with something that you don't actually like. So maybe I've given away the lead here because I probably know what you think. But I'm going to make you, just because I'm fun and I get to host this thing, I'm going to make you try and take both sides of this particular argument. One of the great long-term wealth creation strategies for investors for decades and decades and decades has been investing in dividend-paying shares. Now, we know that dividends record something around half of the total return, at least in Australia, of shares is delivered from dividends, the other half from capital growth. So if you're not investing in dividend-paying shares, your capital's got to kind of grow twice as fast, if you like, as companies are paid dividends, at least on the basis of that average, and that's a bit of a wonky average, but, you know, work with me roughly. So dividend investing has, for the longest time, been a wonderful way to invest, a wonderful way to accumulate wealth. Plenty of people of different amounts of fame have done it for years and swear by it. The thing is, I don't think you've ever bought a dividend and paying share in your life, have you?
I've got a few.
A few?
Yeah, but I mean, you know.
Well, Apple pays a dividend,
well,
I suppose.
I'm not buying companies for the sake of buying dividends, you know, or sake of getting dividends. So if the dividends are a happy byproduct of my strategy.
Interesting.
But you know, I can see.
I'm going to just direct this here a little bit. Give us some pro. Why should our listeners be considering dividend investing as a core part of their investment portfolio?
Right. So number one, I think again, this is all general advice. So
of course,
it all depends on what you want to do, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want a steady stream of income, mm-hmm. and you want to, you know, have your capital that grows slowly, yep. then dividend investing makes a lot of sense, right? So I mean, if you can get 5% or 4.5% dividend, and then get some franking on top of it, that's really, really good. And then if you can, you know, if over the long term your capital appreciates slowly, maybe another couple of half, you know, 2-3%, that's a pretty good, you know, market-ish return maybe, or a little bit ahead of market maybe, depending on what you think the market's going to do. And that might be actually okay for someone who wants to live off the dividend and have some capital that is growing, which is a great, like, say, retirement strategy.
All right, so slow and steady wins the race. I'm going to separate out one thing you mentioned in passing there, was you also mentioned those franking credits. That's another key part, particularly in Australia, another good reason to be a dividend investor. What's the value of franking credits for the average punter?
Well, again, it depends on what the tax rate is, right? But the dividends are basically attached to the 30%, at the 30% marginal tax rate, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a, you know, fair. If you're paying less than that, I mean, you're going to get all of that dividend franking basically back to you.
Right. So a dollar of interest in the bank is worth a dollar. A dollar of rent from a tenant is worth a dollar. A dollar's worth of dividend income, though, is worth about $1.40, at least in like-for-like terms. So when they say, well, dividend, you get a dividend yield of 4%, that's kind of the equivalent of, say, 6-ish% in, you know, compared to, say, property or cash in the bank. So there is real value in that. That's franking credits. It's real money, right? It's real yeah. savings you're making against the tax you'd otherwise pay if your income came from any other source.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, 5.6% is what you'd get, right?
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of value there. You get, and if you, depending on where you are in terms of your tax, your income and taxes, you might actually be getting a refund back to you.
That'd be pretty nice.
So that's pretty nice.
Two big reasons. Give me a third, Matt. What's another third reason to plump for dividend investing?
Oh, well, again, if you're a conservative investor and, you know, most dividend-paying stocks are likely to be blue-chip companies, mm-hmm. so they're likely to be less volatile and they're likely to be, you know, not disappear from the planet and things like that.
If you've got the balance sheet strength and the cash flow to pay a dividend, you're doing pretty well.
You're doing pretty
compared
well.
Compared to a company that doesn't, you're either... It's just less certain, right? It's less confident, yeah. less balance sheet strength, generally speaking.
So you're getting less volatility. Which is, again, depends on the type of investor. If you are scared away by volatility easily, then dividend investing is good.
I mean, I saw something funny, mate. You're the ultimate, well, relatively non-dividend investor.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing about this is my favorite company doesn't pay a dividend, but your favorite company does. It's just very, very bizarre.
It's just my favorite company is awesome, and your favorite company is still not awesome.
It's only worth about $300,000 a share. Of course, I talk about Berkshire Hathaway. Doc talks about Apple, and we respectively own those two companies, for full disclosure. So, which kind of talks to the cons of dividend investing. I'll make you say something nice about Berkshire, just in passing. But specifically, I'm gonna load the gun on the first con of dividend investing, which is the lack of ability for quality companies to reinvest that cash flow. Tell us a bit about why that can be a con for an investor.
Right. So if you have a lot of growth opportunities ahead of you, mm-hmm. then you probably want to take all that earning that you have retained, which you've not paid out. So by retained, I mean not paid out via dividends to your shareholders, mm-hmm. reinvest in the business. So it basically depends on the rate of return you can get on the reinvestment, right? And yep. if that rate of return is going to be substantially high and you can compound it over a period of time, mm-hmm. that's what you want to do.
Right.
So in a way, dividends paid by a company are a signal that we're generating this cash, we don't have an opportunity to reinvest it at a high rate of return.
Well, this if we're not prepared to or investors are demanding they not do it, but in any case,
yeah. if you can
reinvest at 20% and they're going to pay you out at 10%,
yeah.
you want them to reinvest the cash, right? If I owned a business and the business could spend $1,000 to go and generate another $1,000 in profit, or they give it to me and I can put it at the bank and earn 1%, well, I'd rather them keep the money and generate more cash.
Exactly. But I mean, you know, that's the theory. I think in reality, and nothing works exactly like that. So a lot of companies would pay dividend because they feel that that helps them get to a certain shareholder base because that shareholder base expects both a little bit of dividend and some growth.
Right.
Right. So there's that. Yeah, but you know, maybe Apple is not a good example. But a company like, say, BHP Billiton, they pay a lot of the, you know, maybe 70-80% of their money back in dividends. I don't know what their payout ratio is, but I'm guessing it's pretty high. A lot of our banks, you know, for whatever their cash profits are, they would pay up to like 80-90% of their 90 cash.
90 plus, I think.
Because again, it's an acknowledgement that they don't have those growth opportunities, but they're, you know, they're cash cow as a business. Mm-hmm. As long as, you know, they can continue milking that cash,
and their investors are used to it, right? So any bank that said, "Hey, we're going to halve our dividend because we're going to go invest in growth," the shares would get absolutely slaughtered because the dividend investors would desert them in droves. At some degree, you want to be careful. It's the old, there was an old, well, it's probably apocryphal, but the story of the street sign that said, "Choose your rut carefully; you'll be in it for the next 5 miles." It's kind of about that, right? Like once you start down a path, trying to get out of that, you know, kind of direction or that decision is tough. Why else wouldn't you invest in dividend paying shares, mate?
Well, I think if you want high returns, I don't think they're going to come from, like if a company is paying 90% of its money out in dividends, it's really left with little, which is, again, as we discussed, an acknowledgement of A, lack of growth opportunities, and B, less money available for growth, right? Yep. So if you want growth, and that's where a lot of the returns, high returns come from, is, you know, if you want to invest in something like, you know, that can, like Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. It could be generating profits and paying dividends, or it could be, you know, putting it back into the machine. You know, it's like the machine that feeds the machine. And if the machine becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, the share price goes up and therefore the returns go up, right?
That's a great point. And not only the returns and the share price, but just simply the market dominance or its market position. I mean, Amazon's been growing at 20%. And again, you and I both own shares. Amazon's been growing at 20% per annum for the last decade-ish. I'll really round numbers, but let's just say that.
It's probably more than 20% in the last decade.
Right.
It's only like 20% in the last, I should say. Last 3 years.
Yes. So if it had been forced to pay out half of its profits or frankly make losses to pay out some cash or whatever it was, that growth rate would have been materially impacted. Because at some point, either it would have not been able to reinvest, or frankly, would have had to go and raise more capital to justify the dividends it was paying out while it was losing money.
Yeah.
That compound value of that 20, 30, 40% growth a year, it's probably gone up, Matt, you'll correct me, would it have grown tenfold in 10 years on the back of that? It must have been close.
Yeah.
If that tenfold growth in size and scale and market dominance and all that kind of stuff had been threefold or twofold, would it have been a good return? Absolutely. But gee, an Amazon that was one-fifth of the size, in the face of the Baidus and the Flipkarts out of India and the resurgent Walmarts, I don't know if any Amazon shareholder, even if they wanted the dividends at the time, do you really want Amazon shares today when if the company is only, you know, a fifth or a tenth of its size? You really need to, you know, strategically reinvest in businesses, particularly if market dominance is your goal, simply just if growth is your goal that you want to create. And frankly, when Amazon decides to pay a dividend, it'll be a much, much bigger business then than it is today if it had never paid that dividend.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
Mate, last one on the con side. You talked a little bit about if you want high returns, you're probably not going to get it from dividends. You don't invest in dividend paying stocks. That to me tells, or generally speaking, that to me tells a story of the relative average return you expect to get because of that potential to grow over time. And the fact that we've kind of talked about it, but just to put a finer point on it, the compound growth you can get with higher growth for longer periods of time. Your bet, if not deliberately, certainly by as a result of the way you invest, is that you're hoping for higher capital return on the basis of, I guess, a faster growing business. So strategically, how do you think about your portfolio as a non-dividend investor, and why is it superior to a dividend paying portfolio in your view?
Yeah, so I wouldn't call it superior in the sense that you know, it's superior for me, which might not be superior for somebody else.
Sure,
right.
Good point.
For me, I think I'm basically trading off volatility. I'm willing to take volatility. I'm willing to accept my shares drop a lot over short periods of time. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to forego the income stream in return for, you know, double of the return that I would potentially get from dividend paying stocks, right? Well, my belief, and there's probably data that, you know, the dividend paying stocks would probably give you, maybe if you've got good dividend, you know, like what they call dividend aristocrats or things like that, you might beat the market by, you know, a couple of percentage points.
Which would be nice.
Which is great, right? I mean, over the long term, that is awesome. And you've got capital preservation and all those things happening for you. I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to beat the market by, like, you know, 5-6, you know, if I can, even 10 percentage points, right? Mm. And in return for that, I am taking some risks. So I think it's just a risk-reward trade-off that one is making, along with acceptance of volatility.
Yep.
In the make. Again, like, you know, again, it depends on what people can. It's one thing to say that I'll, you know, people might say that I will take the higher return, but if they can't tolerate the volatility that comes with it, then they can't actually get the higher return because they'll probably be selling at the wrong time.
Mm. So overall, your bet is that a well-chosen list of growth stocks would beat a well-chosen list of dividend-paying stocks over time. By investing in Amazon, the average Amazon rather than the average bank, one might give you steady, stable, kind of reliable cash flows-ish, although the banks won't be without their volatility. But the average Amazon, chosen well, should do better over time and give you that outperformance you're looking for.
Oh, yeah. Like if I can repeat and, if you know, go back in time, I would buy, like, you know, Amazon every day.
Right.
Right. And I would let it compound. And then when I need my dividend, I just sell a few shares. Right. I mean, you can always generate income out of growth stocks when you need it just by selling a little bit. Right. So that's my strategy. I can generate my own dividend by selling, you know, basically taking capital gains when I need to, when I need to generate dividends. Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, you need not think of dividend paying stocks as the only way to get income. There are many ways to get income, right? You know, taking some capital gains is also a type of income, right? So,
yeah. And again, to return to Berkshire just quickly, and I know it's not your favorite non-dividend paying stock, but Buffett has said, and he presented the maths, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago in one of the annual letters. People were saying, hey, pay a dividend. And in hindsight, maybe you should have, quite frankly, at least in the last few years. But over time, he's shown that if you just sold a little bit of your own Berkshire holdings over time, rather than being paid a dividend of the equivalent size, you've done much, much better because of Berkshire's ability to compound what's left rather than you taking the money out. So on a total return basis, if you have a company that is able to grow its top and bottom lines at a faster rate than you can by reinvesting it, you want to let it do its thing and sell when you need to, rather than pay a dividend for an uncertain reinvestment rate.
Agreed.
Very good.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
I want to go to a topic now, which isn't miles away from our just last conversation about dividend investing, and, well, particularly non-dividend investing that you tend to pursue, because I want to talk a little bit about investors' expectations here. And look, I think the biggest hurdle, and frankly the biggest opportunity for most investors, I would almost say every investor, but it's probably too grandiose and maybe it doesn't cover exactly everybody. For most people, the thing that is going to stop them being as successful as they want to be, or the thing that can make them more successful than they otherwise would be, is not the ability to understand business or read a balance sheet or go to accounting classes or read the AFR or something like that. It's the ability to control our own emotions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a study out that says the average managed fund loses to the market, but the average managed fund investor loses compared to the average managed fund because they can't help themselves but trade in and out of managed funds over time. So the market might do 10, the average managed fund might do 8, and the average investor does like 4 because they simply don't stick with they kind of chase last year's winner. And so that's just one single example of the behavioral biases that tend to drag us down.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, the biggest outside that, the biggest thing that probably costs investors in terms of either actual losses or foregone profits is the inability to ride the waves of volatility. The market can be up and down all over the place. I had an email from a potential member, literally, I answered this morning, saying, well, what happens if the market crashes in 2019? Everyone's talking about it. And of course, my reply, as hopefully our listeners will know by now, is, well, that was also predicted in 2018 and 2017 and 2016. And I could literally go back. Remember, RBS, the investment bank, told their investors to sell everything in January 2016.
Yeah, that would have been a great call for losing money.
Man, and that's the thing. And look, RBS aren't stupid, right? These are sensible, thoughtful people with rational reasons as to why they should. The problem they and other people make is trying to time the market is just over time and time. If RBS can't do it, guys, you can't do it. I can't do it. Doc can't do it. Anyway, so without going too much on a tangent on that one, it's the inability to withstand volatility, the inability to think long-term and think holistically as a total portfolio that can really hurt people. Now, Doc, I know you as an investor are one of the most risk-tolerant people I know. You follow the investment lessons and teachings of David Gardner, one of our co-founders, who has absolutely spanked the market for more than a decade. Is it 20 years yet? Probably is.
Probably 20 years, yes.
With his Rule Breakers portfolio and the portfolio that he ran online before that. The funny thing about David Gardner is he would say, and I'll almost directly quote him, though I haven't got it in front of me, I have picked more losing stocks than anybody at the Motley Fool. I think you would probably say you don't necessarily, you expect to probably pick more losers than winners, I think, in your style of investing. To most investors, that is a massive, massive anathema. If you found that 6 out of 10 of your portfolio were losing money, they would give up, they'd close up shop, they'd go home, they'd buy an index fund, or they'd simply put cash in the bank and say, this investing caper is stupid, it's not for me. I lost money on some of my picks. Now, for me, I'm a kind of a Peter Lynch guy. I'm trying to be right about 6 times out of 10, which also feels like a really low strike rate. You're trying to be right even less than me, and you're doing it deliberately. So I want to talk a little bit about, I've called this how to be wrong more than right and still win. And it's kind of, it's behavioral, but it's also theoretical. And when I say theoretical, I don't mean it's not practical. I just mean there's a very clear theory behind why this makes sense. And for our listeners who are thinking, well, how would I think about investing? This is not for everybody, nor is my style, nor, you know, pick your own style, as Doc said earlier, pick what's right for you. But mate, I really want to dig into this a little bit. I think the answers are low. I'd love to ask you some questions and hear directly from you. But for our listeners, why the hell would you embark on a strategy that you think is probably more likely to lose more often than win, or have more losers than winners, but still win overall? What the hell is going on?
Matt, you know, I don't deliberately pick stocks that are not going to go up. That's not my goal.
No, but you're accept that. You almost embrace the fact that your stock picking will deliver that, even if you try not to.
Yes. So it depends. So one of the things to think about is if you think about the risk-reward spectrum as like a line,
yes,
then as your risk goes up,
yes,
on average, your return should go up, right? That's the theory, right? And that's why when you keep money in the bank, it's very safe. It doesn't really go up.
Right.
You put the money in the stock market, it's a little bit riskier. The money goes up and so on. And the same sort of risk spectrum, you can apply that sort of the same risk-reward spectrum to companies.
Breaks down a little bit though, right? Because if that was true, everyone would get roughly the same result. And we don't all get the same result investing in stocks.
Exactly. So there is, yes. So the thing to remember is, when we're talking about averages, right? If we're talking about averages, that on average this should happen. So you A, need to play the game enough,
yep,
and of course you need to, you know, you need to select according to your belief and your strategy, right? So my strategy really is, and this is what we do in Extreme Opportunities as an example. And again, you know, that service, you know, about now two. Slightly over 2 years old. Now it's beating the market. It has got more losers than winners.
So hang on, I just want to stop there. It's beating the market, yep, but it has more losers than winners.
Yes.
How is that possible?
That's possible because, number one, the maximum you can lose in anything is 100%, right?
Yes.
So something can go broke.
Thankfully, I haven't had that yet, but I'm not far away with a couple of my stock picks.
Well, yeah, we have had a few that are pretty close, or at least one of them that we sold, if we didn't sell, then would have been almost 100%
right
off. You know, we have that as an 83% loss on the scorecard.
That's
right?
Unarguably bad.
It's pretty bad, right? So one of them is 83%. This is probably the highest loss from when we picked it, the then price versus when we sold it, right? And the reason behind that is, you can, again, as I said, maximum loss 100%.
Yes.
Maximum gain is, though, in theory, uncapped. Right.
Right.
So that basically means you can have a 200% gain. So we've got, like, you know, we recommended Volpara very early on. So Volpara is this breast density software company out of New Zealand, which we like to call it ours.
It's ours, correct.
It's ours.
Wonderful Australian company.
Wonderful Australian company. That's up 245%. So that's more than 3x.
Right.
Right. So one winner can now write off, like, you know, two losers and a bit.
So So it would cover entirely. You could have lost all of your money on two of your recommendations,
and still be
ahead.
Yeah, in positive territory, whether or not, and you might even be actually, you know, ahead in terms of the market, because, you know, 45% over 2 years on, you know, over divided by three, you'd probably be pretty close, right?
So the average 10 bagger stock goes up 10 times in value. You could actually have one 10 bagger and 9 that lost everything and still be even.
Yeah, you'd be even. You might not beat the market with but yeah.
Those maths, like, we should actually dwell on that for just a second, because I know you're a pretty modest guy, but if you can do that repeatedly over time, That's where David Gardner's big wins have come from. And he's talked about, you know, he's got some stupid, I think he's got like 60 companies he's recommended in the last 20 years that are down more than 60% or something. There's a massive number of stocks that are down really bad. And yet he's just absolutely destroyed the market for a very long period of time because, as you say, the average winner in his portfolio, certainly in your scorecard so far, the average winner well and truly covers the average loser and then some, which is what lets you deliver a positive return and so far beat the market.
Right. And the other thing that I think in the strategy, again, a lot of these things are psychological, right? So if you need to back the horse that is actually doing well, right? So we picked Volpara early on. Volpara was doing well. Well, we re-wrecked it as well, right?
Okay. So you took a second bite of the cherry.
So you take a second bite of the cherry, right? And you take the second bite of the good cherry and that cherry again delivers, right?
Yep.
So it's one of those things where, and now, like, I mean, you might come back and say, well, you know, why didn't you pick all of them to be Volparas, right? Again, it's because there's going to be a spread of returns, spread of outcomes for these things because it's you're picking early stage. So when we picked Volpara, it was really a tiny company. Risks were high. You know, we were betting on the opportunity in front of them. And that's what we're trying to do with most of our recs. Some of them are just going to fail on the opportunities, right? But some of them are going to succeed. But if they succeed wildly, which is what we think, given their opportunities in terms of, say, total addressable market as an example, then you can come ahead and you are likely to come ahead. Of course, you know, you have to do your research, think about it. But it is something that a lot of people would find hard to do. And also, if you have a few losers early on and you just basically you drop that strategy, I think that the thing is that if you have a strategy, you got to stick with that strategy.
Yep.
As long as you believe that the strategy kind of works for you, you can't mix and match. You know, if you mixed a dividend strategy with this high risk strategy, it's only going to make it worse.
Right.
So those are sort of things that I think you need to keep in mind. In my own personal portfolio, I do that. Now I'll point out one thing. You might start with a company early on that is in that high-risk strategy, which over time is going to then become a lower risk because of the execution benefits and so on, right? And if that happens, you basically can still keep it as long as you believe in its outcomes going forward, right? So the important thing is that you have a strategy, whether or not you are selling because the company is no longer a high-risk company, that's a different matter. That's more of a taking capital gains question. Again, you can ask that question at that point. But it's maybe the simplest way, but you know, if you've got a small cap fund and you buy something into the small cap fund because it's small, and over a period of time it becomes big, you don't have to sell it because you shouldn't necessarily sell it because it's no longer small. Well, it's grown from being small to big, and you can take that strategy in your own portfolio as well.
Well, I think David Gardner's biggest winner is Amazon, which is up like 300 times since he recommended it. If he'd sold it after it was only up a 10-bagger, for example, that's a lot of money left on the table.
Exactly.
The sheer dollar value of that is huge. So, mate, I think that's – so you talk about the fact that your upside is well more than your downsides. That's a win as long as you're picking well. And it doesn't mean you can pick just everything and have that happen because it doesn't happen. You have to be able to pick the companies that genuinely have that opportunity. That being said, you talk about the strategy needs to work. One view of it – and to be just devil's advocate for a second, I would say to you, Doc, that strategy is not working. You're losing. You're wrong more than you're right. Surely that strategy isn't working. You're not very good at this. It's not working out. For all the things, all the confidence you have, it's not coming true. Why is that the wrong way to think about the success or otherwise that you've had with the scorecard so far?
So I think here's the thing. From the very beginning, we've been telling our members that, look, you know, you need to realize how the service is different from the other services we offer, right? And understand that we're going to have a lower strike rate. And what we've always said is that, you know, take a lot of bites across the scorecard. In fact, if you want to reproduce our results, you basically take a bite at everything that we have, right? Mm-hmm. In the way we're taking a bite. But you know, it's an idea service. We provide an idea. You need to follow it. You cannot have small sample. You need to have a large number of samples to use. And that sort of also applies to your portfolio as well. You need to have enough number of bites. And this is like what the venture capital guys do, right? They invest in hundreds of companies with the expectation that only a small number of them are going to turn into Facebooks, right? But when they do, it's like it's one of those paydays, right? Yeah. Like, or like, you know, those people who invested early in, say, Uber, right? They had a big payday when Uber listed, for
that's
example.
Pretty good.
huge payday. So I think that's strategy is working.
Right.
You need to understand the strategy to actually make it work for you is, I think, the most important.
I think that's right. So this is not an ad for Extreme Opportunities, by the way. You can join the service if you want to. That's not my intention at all.
This is not an ad.
I think what's important here. I just want to tease out a potentially different answer to my question. Same answer as yours. Just maybe add some more to it. The reality is that Doc is doing this because he knows it works on average over time in total. And those aren't qualifiers. They're not weasel words. They're not excuses. This is the way the strategy works. Doc would have a high level of confidence that every company has the sorts of characteristics that they need to have so that the strategy on average works out. He knows that even with the level of confidence, with the total addressable market size and the growth potential and the quality of the business and the management, all the things he looks at, he knows that most of those are still going to fail. That's kind of the point. But he also knows, historically speaking, we can't promise anything into the future because A, ASIC wouldn't let us, but B, more importantly, it's simply not ethical and we would never do it because we don't know that it's true. What we know is, historically speaking, if you pick enough of those companies, as we said before, the winners will well and truly swamp the losers. David Gardner's success has proven that. Doc's success thus far has proven that. And so this is not for everybody. We're not suggesting our listeners go and do this in and of themselves. If you don't want to, don't do it. Don't do it just because we say it's a good idea, because if you don't believe in it, you won't do it and you'll fail at it because you'll balk at the first hurdle. That over time, this strategy works. And this is, and you use the VC example, Doc, which I think is a really useful one. VC investors know that only one out of every 20 companies they fund will actually make them any sort of decent money. Most will fail, go to zero. Some will do roughly okay. But the big winners, the Facebooks, the Ubers, the whatever, the Beyond Meats of the world, they will do spectacularly well and more than cover the losses. That's the exact strategy they pursue. They don't look for trying to get 19 out of 20 right, because if they did, they'd never invest in anything, because you can't be that confident about these new hyper-growth companies. Amazon, in hindsight, looks obvious. At the time, it was one of those 20, right? And it was the one that worked out. If you wanted the proof, if you wanted the risk averse kind of, I'll wait till it makes money, well, guess what? It's hardly ever made money. And frankly, you've missed out on the big wins in the meantime. Now, Amazon could have gone to zero, as could have eBay, as could have PayPal, as could have Uber, as could have MySpace, which did, by the way, Facebook, Yahoo, which almost did. And that's kind of the story. You need to be putting together a portfolio of companies with those characteristics, because on average, chosen well, they will win, even though by company by company basis, you may even have more losers than winners, because you need to be investing in that strategy that delivers those winners. How'd I go, Doc?
I think you nailed it.
Beautiful. That was kind of fun.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I want to talk, go from big picture to little picture. I want to talk a little bit about I'll call it a trading strategy, which probably might, for some of our longer-term listeners, give away my thoughts on this one. I want to talk about stop losses. We talked about big picture stuff. We talked about how to be wrong more than right and win. We talked about the pros and cons of dividend investing. Let's get down to tin tacks now. This is the tactics of investing. This is the day-to-day, loading the orders in, making the sell decisions, all that kind of good stuff. The idea of a stop loss is a really, really attractive idea. Your broker calls you and says, look, here's what I can do for you. You want to make money, but you don't want to lose money. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to let you sell your shares automatically if the shares fall by more than a certain amount. If they fall by 10%, we'll sell them automatically for you. You'll save yourself the pain of loss. And the average punter says, well, that feels like, if not too good to be true, that feels like a perfect solution for insurance, right? Because if it goes up, I don't have to sell it. And if it goes down, I get to sell it before it loses even more. Heads, I win. Tails, I don't lose much. That is the best strategy in the entire world, isn't it?
It is probably the worst strategy in the entire world.
But hang on. If the shares fall further, I save myself that pain. Mm. Where's the downside?
Well, there's first a big caveat there. Even with saving, let's start with the saving on the downside.
Yes.
Okay. So let's say you a stock, I'll use an example, is trading at $1.
Yes.
And you send a stop loss at, say, 5% below.
Right. So the shares will be automatically sold if they hit 95 cents.
95 cents, right? Correct. Now,
that's the most I can lose.
Yeah. That's
brilliant.
So the most you can lose is 5 cents.
Brilliant.
Right?
Lock it in.
Now, here's a problem, right? Suppose something happens that temporarily, the key word is temporarily, moves the shares down to 80 cents.
That's right. I get to sell at 95. So I've saved myself 15 cents.
No. If it moved all of a sudden to 80 cents, you'd actually sell at 80 cents, because the stop loss says sell at this or below.
But I'd sell at 95 on the way down, so I'd save myself the 15 cents.
You might not, right? It might just open at 80 cents, or it might open at 85 cents or something like that. So right. First, you can have big movements that could actually cause you to sell below the strike price that you have chosen for the stop loss.
Right. So this is probably something that just bears a little second of pulling out. So shares don't fall by half a cent or a cent strategically, you know, over time, you know, drop, particularly overnight. So they close at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the last price was a dollar. Last trade yesterday afternoon was a buck. And then this morning at 10 a.m., which is when markets open, the shares don't trade, or don't have to. In fact, they almost never do well. That is sometimes. But they don't trade at yesterday's closing price just because yesterday the price closed at a dollar. The price this morning is simply the price at which the buyers and sellers can agree to make the first transaction. And that amount can be a dollar, can be 99 cents, can be $1, or it could be $2 or 50 cents. Because if there's no seller, if there's no buyers at 99 cents, then no shares get traded at 99 cents. If the only buyers are at 80 cents, then the sellers either have to say, I'm not going to sell, or I'm going to sell at 80. But the shares don't have to have traded at any point between 80 cents and a buck. There's no rule that says they have to go down slowly down an escalator. They can simply drop meaningfully, gap down, to use the horrible jargon of the trade, straight to 80 cents. And at that point, Doc, you were alluding to the fact that I'd get my shares sold, but I wouldn't get my 95 cents. Exactly. I'd only get 80 cents because the rules of a stop loss say sell at the prevailing price if it's below or at 95 cents effectively, right? So Whatever the opening price is, that's the price I'm forced to accept. And because it's automatic, no one asks me. It just happens.
Yeah, and it could happen during the day, right? So some announcement comes out and then all of a sudden your buyers and sellers basically agree on some price that's 20% below,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like a trading downgrade, right? A trading downgrade can actually theoretically hit any time during the day.
Right.
So that's number one.
Well, that's disappointing.
Well, that's disappointing, but maybe you're okay that you got out of the scenario.
Oh, I know it.
Okay. Yeah, okay, fine. Let's say that's fine.
Okay, good.
But
at least it hasn't fallen any further. That's a win.
Yeah, so you think you've got a win. But here's the other problem,
lock
right?
It in. Yes.
The other problem is we know that on a day-to-day basis, the shares are going to be volatile, right? So maybe you know something about the shares and therefore you've picked your stop loss accordingly that, you know, on average they move on a daily day, given day, no more than 3%. So therefore,
makes 5% is look pretty good. Yep.
Right. But what if a company falls 5% today?
Yes.
You sell out.
Yes, good. Limited by downside.
You're limited by downside.
Excellent.
Then over the next year, goes on to triple.
Well, that's disappointing.
You've got a small problem.
I've got a big problem.
Yeah. Well, it depends on how you look at it. You've got a small problem that you only got a small amount of loss locked in.
Okay.
Your bigger problem is that you missed all the upside. Right. So,
mate, that'd be pretty gutting, can I tell you?
Yeah.
That'd be really disappointing.
But, you know, the example I like to give people is sometimes even the market actually, the markets, the way they function, sometimes the markets even are not able to actually match the prices and the markets malfunction. So they're not able to match the buyers and sellers. And it's not that, you know, it happens. It has happened on NASDAQ. It has happened to big companies like Apple and Amazon. And the shares all of a sudden have dropped. And they have momentarily dropped because there was some malfunction in the market. And you could be just a forced seller because the market malfunctioned, right?
So that would be brutal, wouldn't it? I'm not sure if that's even particularly worse than being stopped out at any price, but specifically on a malfunction, that kind of adds insult to injury, doesn't it?
Yeah, it just adds insult to injury. So you know, that would suck. That would really suck. You're just selling out on random news.
Yeah.
And and then you're basically trading on short-term volatility, right? I mean, you're trading on short-term volatility. If you're trading on short-term volatility, again, I wouldn't even call it being an investor because you're not really being an investor. You're just speculating on short-term price movements. And you're potentially giving up a lot of, you know, upside, right? So
I'm going to add to that, mate, for a little bit. Like, you've absolutely nailed it. I think the other thing for me is that if you have bought some shares, so let's say you're an investor, right? Let's hypothetically say if you're investing in the ASX, you're actually an investor. You're investing because you believe the price of Woolies, to pick just a random company name that neither of us own, you think Woolies is undervalued, right? You think Woolies is a good long-term investment. It's going to hopefully beat or match the market return over an extended period of time. If that's not your view, by the way, you have no business investing. So let's make that really, really clear. I don't mind being a little bit controversial. If you're trying to bet on the next day or week or month's price movement, you are not investing, you are gambling. Go and put it on the dogs or on the casino. Go with black. Black's a winner. If you're an investor, you're investing for the long term. If your hypothesis on Woolworths is so so shaky that you're prepared to say, hey, if the share price falls 5%, I'm going to accept that I'm wrong and sell. That is just absolute madness. You are literally, you're letting the market tell you. And in fact, if you let the market tell you what to do, buy an ETF. If you think the market's right, great, buy an ETF. You have no business owning shares if you think the market's right, because you can't beat the market if the market's right. You might as well buy an ETF and match the market. That's the best you can do by definition. If you think the market's wrong and you're going to buy woolly shares because they're undervalued, then great. Except guess what? If the market's wrong now, why is the market not still wrong if the shares fall another 5%? Why would you let the market tell you that you're wrong then, but not now? It's just absolute stonking madness. Not only that, but guess what? As Doc says, when the share price then goes on to triple, you're going to have been stopped out. You're going to have been right about woolies, but what do you get to show for it? A locked in 5% or 10% loss. That is just absolute madness. There is so much. We talked a little bit a couple of weeks ago about some toxic financial products and talked about the fact that some of those are basically products invented by people who are going to make money clipping the ticket, making a small commission every time you do something, every time they convince you to take an action, make a trade, do something that makes them money, doesn't make you money, makes them money. It's the same with stop losses, right? They prey on your fear. Wouldn't you like to avoid a loss? Well, of course I would. What if I could give you something to avoid that loss? Well, I'd take that. Guess what? That's a stop loss order. You feel like you've been smart, you've made the right decision. Here's the other thing. Markets go up more often than they go down. They go up more than they go down. Why would you want to be stopped out of a position, out of it, just because the share price falls 5%? It makes absolutely no, even if you lose to the market, you're still likely on average for your shares to go up, because that's kind of what happens. So being stopped out at a 5% loss, if you're a trader, good luck to you. If you're an investor, please ignore the stop losses. To Doc's point, frankly, the Doc's own strategy couldn't work with stop loss orders. Even the strategy I employ, which is less, I'm swinging for the fences a little bit less. I'm still wrong more often. Right more often than I'm wrong, but not by much. That's still, I've lost decent amounts of money on, I think, most of the positions that have done very, very well. Corporate Travel Management, a stock I own, is a 10 bagger for ShareAdvisor at the moment. That means it's gone up 10 times in value. It's fallen more than 2 or 3 or 5% so many times, I even don't want to count them. It's just all over the place. It's really, really volatile on day-to-day basis, but it's up 10 times. I would hate to think, went from 240 to 24-ish, give or take. Take some dividends and stuff in there, but call that the range. The number of times that we would be forced to sell at 3 or 4 or 5 or 7 or 10 or 12 and missed out on the run to 24 just makes absolutely no sense. If you are picking stocks, you're buying them because you're going to beat the market over the long term. Don't let the market stop you out after 5 or 10% of a fall that happens from time to time anyway, as Doc's already said. It's what markets do. It's absolute madness. If you don't have enough conviction to hold them if they fall 5%, you shouldn't own them at all. How's that, Doc?
I think that is great. I'm going to add just one thing.
Please
say the markets are always wrong.
Oh, okay. That's controversial. Go on. Markets are always... For blokes who work in the financial markets, mate, that's not doing wonders for our career prospects, but try and dig us out of this hole.
So markets are wrong in the sense that, again, we said that markets are wrong in the short term, right? But, the short term, basically, if you are wrong today about something, they're probably wrong about it 5 years from now. It's just the quantum of wrong has just changed, right?
That's so interesting. Okay.
It's basically, I was just thinking about this. So, people say, markets are wrong in the short term. They're going to be, we're going to be right in the long term.
Right.
The thing is that the emotions, the reason that the market is wrong, which is the emotions and all the behavioral mm-hmm. behavioral aspects that people have, and the
fear, greed, euphoria,
and
pessimism.
Well, it doesn't
short-termism.
That is the thing that is omnipresent always.
That's fair.
So what really happens is that you buy a company today, and as you said, that's exactly right? You buy a company today because you think that the market hasn't got it right.
Yeah.
Even 10 years from now, the market probably is not right. You might just sell and with a lot of profit because market has realized some aspect of it.
Okay.
And there's still some aspect that it hasn't realized, right? Which is why a lot of companies keep compounding for a long time. Anyway, that's my new theory today, made on the spot.
I like that. That's a whole different conversation to have. What I quite like about that, I think I would say, you may not even disagree with this necessarily, but I would say over time, the market gets it directionally right. But the specifics are often wrong, as you say, right through the process. If Woolies is twice as big in 5 years' time, then there's a fair chance that profits are twice the size and the share price will have moved to some degree in rough accordance with that value creation. As you say, still might be wrong for emotional behavioral reasons, but conceptually, kind of if you draw a profit line from top left to bottom right, the share price is going to go in roughly the same direction, even if not the same quantum, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. So right. So it doesn't mean that Woolies today, for example, is correctly priced, right?
Right, yes.
Today
yes.
is also incorrectly yeah, priced. Whether right. on the upside or downside, it's yes. for you to decide. Right,
right, right. Right.
But what I'm saying is that the incorrect pricing is
yep.
always there.
Yep.
It's just the market. Market is basically always inefficient. Whether it's the upside or downside, it's for you to decide.
It's a really good point. And, you know, and again,
I should just basically quit and become a theorist.
Oh, right, okay. But you don't get paid very well for that.
You're
paid better picking stocks and talking about it.
Well, is that what you're telling me?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about that.
Depends how popular, famous you get.
I don't know.
Plenty of people get very rich selling doom and gloom books. There's people who've been bearish, I kid you not, since 1979.
But then that's exactly what I need to do, write a book.
What are you going to call your book?
Doom and gloom. If that's what's going to sell.
The doctor's in the house and the patient is sick. I can see it now. I'll do your marketing, mate. You do the book and we'll both move to an island somewhere. You get most of the cut, but I got to get something for the marketing, surely.
And unlike you, I'm not going to Bahamas. I'm going to Greek island.
The Greek island? That's a good idea.
See, everybody says going to Bahamas, but the better place to go is to Greek.
Greece, not bad.
Islands in Greece.
You know what I reckon? I reckon I would buy myself an island on the Whitsundays.
That sounds awesome.
How good would that be?
That's awesome.
Every time I go to Hamilton Island, I've only been there a couple of times, so I say every time, I keep trying to convince my wife to buy a house up there, but she's not going to do it.
She just wants you to buy the island. You're saying buy the house. She's
mate,
smart.
Just quite a bit that much money, I wouldn't be here either. But so yes, you can buy an island in Greece, I'll buy one on the Whitsundays and we'll go and visit each other.
Okay, that sounds like an awesome plan.
Do we keep doing the podcast?
Oh, we'll see. We'll have to ask Will about that.
I'm sure Will will happily come to the Greek islands or to the Whitsundays to help us.
He's nodding. He's nodding in agreement.
All right. I think that's a good time to wrap it up.
Yeah, I think so.
If we're lucky, next week we'll be coming to you live from either Lemnos or Hamilton Island. In the meantime, that wraps us up. But before we go, don't forget you can and should subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, leave us a review, leave us a comment, send us a plane ticket to Hamilton Island. Okay, maybe not the last one. Although, if you want to, feel free. And please do tell your friends because they could use some foolish insight too, and you never know. If you're on Hamilton Island, you might want someone to buy you a drink, and maybe that might just be us. Don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to www.fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.